Great. Thanks, Marty. As was just said, David asked us to give a fairly low-level talk to try and describe what our program's about and why the heck we're here. I guess I wanted to start by thanking my co-organizers for foregoing their opportunity to get a free lunch. There's no free lunch? Gravity in higher dimensions has long been seen as sort of part of the road to unification, and it's still true today that one of the strongest motivations for understanding general relativity in higher dimensions comes from trying to learn about superstring theory, which is most naturally formulated or seen as a theory that exists in 10 dimensions. As the title of the talk implies, with Scanning New Horizons, and certainly the discussions in the first couple of weeks, the main focus of our program is on black holes in these higher dimensional theories. And black holes are representative of gravity in an extreme situation, and so they've been over the years a source of a number of interesting ideas and insights into superstring theory. And so basically what I wanted to try and introduce you to were some of the interesting peculiarities but also familiar effects that you see when you look at black holes in higher dimensional gravity. But in order to have sort of a base for comparing and contrasting, I wanted to start by talking a little bit about four-dimensional black holes. And so there I thought it might be interesting to put this all on some historical backdrop. And so here's my story for black holes in four dimensions. Well, I guess some of us may want to start the story way back in the late 1700s, but there's not enough room. At that time, John Mitchell in England, and I guess Simon Laplace in France, speculated about the idea of there being stars where the escape velocity would be larger than the speed of light. But this is a, well, this is a program about general relativity, so I'm starting my story here. In 1915, towards the end of the year, Einstein finally came up with a consistent theory of general relativity describing gravity in terms of space-time curvature. It was probably less than a month after that that Karl Schwarzschild came up with a spherically symmetric solution, and that's a solution that we today recognize as the simplest black hole solution. Similar solutions arrived in the next couple of years. Both Reisner and Nordström independently studied spherically symmetric solutions with an electric field in the background. And those gave rise to the solution that bears their name, the Reisner-Nordström solution, which we think of as describing electrically charged black holes today. Now, there's a big empty spot on the board here, which is supposed to represent the activity on black holes, or perhaps the understanding of black holes in their intermediate years. Physicists spent a lot of time ignoring the question as to what happens at R equals 2m in the Schwarzschild solution. And it was only in the late 50s or the late or early 60s that people began to, well, first of all, understand that the singularity that you see there in Schwarzschild's metric is not a real singularity, but only a coordinate artifact, but also to consider whether or not such backgrounds or such solutions could arise in the collapse of reasonable physical systems. And so once again, well, in the 60s in particular, I guess, John Wheeler and his group in Princeton, Zeldovich in Moscow, sort of started an army or started a lot of activity thinking about black holes. One of the events that I've marked here was 1963, Roy Kerr wrote down a solution that was describing a spinning black hole. The intense or the enormous study or the activity continued, and by the early 70s there were a number of remarkable results. Not only did people understand that this was a solution describing a spinning black hole, but it was the solution describing a spinning black hole. There were various theorems describing, well, sometimes known as uniqueness theorems or no-hair theorems, or there were also studies of stability. But basically, the bottom line was that in any collapse, the situation or the metric would settle down to this Kerr solution here, and it would be described basically by these two charges or these two numbers, the mass and the angular momentum. And that was all that there would be left. Or all that was required to describe the space-time at the late time. There was also a set of rules or a set of interesting results known as black hole mechanics that were written down in the early 70s, and these describe transitions. If I had one of these black holes and I threw something at it, then the black hole changes. In particular, the mass and the angular momentum would change, but this combination of those changes characterized very specific changes in the properties of the black hole, in particular the area of the event horizon. There was also a result that the area of the event horizon in any one of these transitions could only increase. And so these then sort of characterized the state of our knowledge of black holes. Hawking then came along in 1974, very shortly afterwards though, and said that these rules of black hole mechanics were actually rules of black hole thermodynamics. What he found was that when one took into account quantum effects, that in fact there was a temperature given by the surface gravity, which was this quantity in front of our first law of black hole mechanics. And so that allowed him to identify both the temperature here, but then the area, as Bekenstein had suggested, was also describing an entropy that was intrinsic in the black hole. And Hawking's result then allowed us to identify the precise coefficient relating the entropy, I guess that should have been F, sorry, the entropy and the area of the event horizon. So that's basically the story of our theoretical knowledge of the four-dimensional black holes. I put one more date here, which is 1994. In 1994, what happened was that a team using the Hubble telescope identified or provided evidence that at the center of this elliptical galaxy, M87, there should be a very massive black hole with a mass of the order of 10 to the 8 solar masses. And there was some discussion of other candidates, Cygnus X1, in the intermediate period, but I think this was really the event or the discovery that outed black holes, in that prior to that time, I think, at least from my perspective, astronomers saw black holes as simply mathematical oddities. But in a very short amount of time, black holes made it onto the scene as astrophysical workhorses. And they were powering a number of very interesting events or objects that we could see around us. Now that's a good thing, because that means that everybody in the other program is going to be familiar with the idea of black holes. On the other hand, that familiarity brings certain preconceptions with it. In particular, I'm sure that most of the astronomers think of black holes as being some of the most energetic objects or providing some of the most violent environments in the universe. And that's certainly not the kind of black hole that we're describing or that we're talking about in our studies of higher dimensions. The black holes that we're describing are more in this era. These are the black holes that Chandrasekhar described as the most perfect macroscopic objects in the universe at the beginning of his book that was entitled Mathematical Studies, or the Mathematical Theory of Black Holes. And so one has to set aside some of the preconceptions in the rest of the talk when I'm talking about the higher dimensional case. So I guess I'll pause there and just ask if anybody wants to make any comments, ask questions, revise my history. Okay, if not, then we can go on. Oh, was there a... Well, we'll get there. This was D equals 4. So now we should talk about D greater than 4. So I didn't want to start with the black holes. Rather, the idea of thinking about gravity in higher dimensions actually happened very early on in the game. In 1921, Kaluza was doing work. 1926, there was another paper by Klein. And basically, their idea was to use higher dimensional gravity to unify the forces in nature. At that time, the forces that we knew about were gravity and electromagnetism. And so it's a very simple idea that, in fact, we still follow today, that if I have, say, a five-dimensional black hole or a five-dimensional metric, well, there's a piece in here that looks like a four-dimensional metric, but I can also use the off-diagonal pieces, the pieces with a five coordinate. This is going to look like a vector, and so it can play the role of a vector potential. Of course, there's also this embarrassing G55, the last component in the metric, which seems to act like a massless scalar field. But basically, the idea here was that by going to higher dimensions, I'm getting other kinds of interactions, other kinds of fields in my four-dimensional world. And so this was then the simple motivation behind thinking about gravity or general relativity in higher dimensions. Of course, if I'm in this five-dimensional theory, we don't see ourselves wandering around in four spatial dimensions. And so one has to accompany the extra dimension by changing the topology of... the topology of the space-time. And so this fifth direction, in this particular case, the simplest thing to do is make it a circle direction. And so the reason that we're not wandering around or we don't perceive this fifth dimension is simply that we're looking at it. If it's a very small circle, perhaps we're looking at it with insufficient resolution. And so it remains there to be discovered by looking at shorter and shorter distance scales. Now, this kind of discussion of unification carried on through the 20s, through the 30s, but interest in those kinds of topics waned later on, because what was discovered was that electromagnetism and gravity were not the only forces in nature. In particular, there was a strong force involved in the behavior of hadrons, or protons, neutrons, pions, those kinds of particles which were being discovered. And later on, there was also the discovery of the weak force. And so this would have been an incomplete story of unification. And, well, there were other things to work on, more interesting things to focus on in physics. And so these ideas lay dormant until the late 70s, but they are, as I said, resurrected in our modern interpretation or in our modern attempts to produce unified theories or quantum theories of gravity. Now, there was a question about black holes in higher dimensions. Even though the Kaluza-Klein program lay fallow, it turned out that in 1963, in fact, a gentleman by the name of Tangerini, who was just interested or asking the question, what would happen if the universe was five-dimensional or six-dimensional? How would physics be different if we changed the dimension of space-time? And so what he did is he extended Schwarzschild solution or spherically symmetric solutions to higher dimensional gravity. And so he found the equivalent solution describing a spherically symmetric black hole in an arbitrary number of dimensions. And basically, its properties were very much like the properties of the Schwarzschild solution. In particular, if I look at the radial component of the inverse metric, I get this 1 minus gm over r to some power. And so basically what I've done is replace the 1 over r, which is the solution of Laplace's equation in 3 plus 1, by the appropriate power here, the solution of Laplace's equation in higher dimensions. And of course, there's the possibility that this component of the metric goes to zero, indicating that there's a surface of infinite redshift at some critical radius. And just as in the four-dimensional case, one can recognize what that critical radius is in a number of ways. In particular, if we restore the c squared, here what we recognize is the formula for the escape velocity of some gravitating sphere going to the speed of light. And so this was the motivation oh so long ago for thinking about black objects or black stars. Coincidentally, the classical formula is precisely reproduced in four dimensions and here again in higher dimensions. Alternatively, another way of thinking about it is if I take the formula and multiply by an m, roughly what I have is the rest mass of the object here, and on this side, a measure of the gravitational self-energy. And so if I take that mass and compress it, what this is telling me is that when I reach a critical radius, or the equivalent of the Schwarzschild radius, where the rest energy is equal to this gravitational self-energy, what happens is the system has to undergo a gravitational collapse. And so basically then the story here is identical to the story that we had in four dimensions, or that was recognized later on in four dimensions. It's just that we had to change this power here. Now, as we go along, various things happen. Strings, I said, were a motivator. So in the late 70s, strings made their first appearance as the theory of hadrons. This was later thrown out and replaced by QCD, earning some people Nobel Prizes, I suppose. But there was an interesting transition again in 1974 here. In that year, Schirk and Schwartz recognized that string theory could be looked at from a new perspective, where it was a theory of general relativity or a theory of gravity in 10 dimensions. And so that we should rescale some of the parameters and change our perspective. And rather than looking for a theory of hadrons here, one is looking for a theory of quantum gravity in higher dimensions. I also said that in the late 70s, there was a revival of the Kaluza-Klein idea. There was a lot of interest in supergravity. rather than string theory, as an attempt to produce a consistent theory of quantum gravity. Ultimately that failed, but it restored interest in the Kaluza-Klein idea of some 60 years before. And the next date that I wrote down here was around 84, we had our first superstring revolution, or alternatively revival. And there were a number of technical advances, but it spurred a great deal of interest in all things stringy. And it actually motivated Malcolm Perry and myself to think about black holes in higher dimensions. And so, in fact, around that time, we produced a description of spinning black holes in higher dimensions. And very briefly, the motivation had to do with a property of strings, and the vague idea that we had was that perhaps we can identify the states of microscopic strings in some sense with black holes. Now that idea failed at this time, although it's something that's grown to be understood in different ways in a more modern context. But the property then that strings had is that when we looked at the spectrum of the strings, the states are arranged in what are called Regge trajectories. But in particular, there's this leading trajectory, and one finds that J is less than M squared. And there's some coefficient in here related to the tension of the strings that then defines the maximum angular momentum that a string of a given mass can carry. If we go back to the Kerr solution over here, what one found was that this formula was replaced by something like, well, it was replaced by J over M squared, R squared, plus and so, well, if I reinstate my M here, what this is telling me now is here's the rest mass term, here's a term describing the gravitational self-energy, and this term I can take as a measure of the kinetic energy associated with the rotation of the black hole. And so this term appears with a positive sign, of course, and what that's saying then is that if I'm spinning this object, or if I'm spinning my mass, then it's going to resist the gravitational collapse that we talked about here. And so in particular, though, if I look at the powers, because this is coming in with the power r squared, it can be that if there's too much angular momentum there, that this term will always dominate the gravitational term, and in fact, I won't produce a gravitational collapse. And if one looks at the possibility or what the critical value of the angular momentum is to produce that, one finds the Kerr bound which said that, again, the angular momentum had to be less than the square of the mass. And so there was this curious parallel then between the behavior of the strings and the black holes, and we thought, well, perhaps this is some kind of indication of a correspondence between these two kinds of objects. But string theory being a theory in 10 dimensions, we should go looking for black holes in higher dimensions. And unfortunately, the story didn't work out quite the same way. At the end of the day, one has a very similar formula. Here, we can stick the M in here if we want. But basically, the gravitational potential looks like the gravitational potential that we saw here in higher dimensions, 1 over r to the d minus 3 being the appropriate power to solve Laplace's equation there. When I'm talking about spinning, I'm just talking about going around in circles in some given plane. And so the power here is completely independent of the number of dimensions because spinning is basically something that involves motions in a plane. And so this term doesn't depend on the number of dimensions that we've embedded the solution in. Now, what I argued here was that this bound arose because the gravitational potential, or that the angular momentum might overwhelm the gravitational self-energy. On the other hand, here, by going to higher and higher dimensions, the gravitational self-energy comes in with a higher and higher power. And so it turns out that if I go to dimensions larger than 5, or d greater than or equal to 6, where this power is 3 or some higher power, then in fact the gravitational self-energy will always be able to dominate the angular momentum. And so in this case, even no matter how hard I spin, there will be no bound. I will always eventually undergo gravitational collapse. So this then is the first indication that there's some difference between black holes in 4 dimensions and in higher dimensions. The story, if you think about this analogy a little bit too hard, you might see that I'm cheating you. If you look at the zeros here, or the solution of this equation, one of the things you note is what I'm doing is I've got my negative term here, I'm adding something positive. And so if I look at the horizon radius for j not equal to 0, that's going to be actually less than the radius for j equals 0. So what that seems to be saying is that when I increase the angular momentum, the system's getting smaller. On the other hand, the natural thing to think is that when I start spinning something, it should be getting bigger. And, well, the resolution is that this radius is actually, in some sense, a transverse radius. If you look at the details of the metric, if you look at the geometry that this solution is describing, what you find is that the horizon does what you think it should. It spreads out in the plane where the rotation is, and so this radius is becoming larger and larger. It's actually proportional to the angular momentum, but if you like, there's a transverse radius, or the thickness of our pancake, and that's the r that this is describing. So this radius, or that horizon radius, that coordinate position, is actually more or less equated with the thickness of our pancake, and so it gets thinner and thinner, but on the other hand, it's actually spreading out in the plane of rotation. And so, yeah?
Is it obvious that J goes in here as a planar J?
No, in fact, you're right that higher dimensions actually are more complicated than I've made them out to be. What I've introduced, or what I've thought about here, is spinning in a single plane. But as you're indicating, you know, when I go to higher dimensions, there are lots of other planes. And so in each one of these planes, I can introduce, if you like, polar coordinates, and so I can think about spinning in that plane, I can think about spinning in this plane, etc., etc., etc. And so, in general, I have much more than just a single parameter describing the spins. In fact, I've got, well, if I'm in odd dimensions, so for example 5, I've got d minus 1 over 2 possible spins. Thank you. So for an even number of dimensions, one of these guys gets left over, and so that becomes a D minus 2. But you're right. Spin, I mean, we're used to thinking of it as a vector that we associate with the axis of spin, but that's a curiosity of three dimensions. When we're in higher dimensions, we really have to think of it as a two-index object, a two-form, actually, that's associating the spin with a particular plane. And in fact, because I've got lots of planes, that two-form or that two-index object can have lots of independent entries. And so this story actually gets modified when I take that into account. Basically, one might think that, well, if I've got lots of spins, I'm just going to add a lot of contributions here. But in fact, life is a little more complicated. Certainly at low spin, that's the story. But in fact, if I take into account lots of large spins, the story actually involves a product like this. And so there are lots of cross terms appearing here, which you can think of as relativistic corrections to the low spin analog. But if this is a product, then for each one of these spins, the top term here is gaining an extra power of r squared. And so if I turn on all of the spins, then in fact this is going to go like d minus 1. And again, we're in a situation like we had in four dimensions where the angular momentum could in fact prevent the gravitational collapse. So the general story is more complicated. And this is a, well, the simplest version. But it turns out that in higher dimensions, or say in D greater than or equal to 6, if I turn off any one of the spins, that's enough to prevent or to allow the self-energy to overwhelm the system and to produce a gravitational collapse. And so, what that's saying then is there is this complicated story in general. In a lot of cases, there is no bound on the angular momentum. There's nothing like the Kerr bound. This simple story that we were looking for up here is wrong. On the other hand, just thinking about black holes in higher dimensions, we can be satisfied that we had a general solution that described spinning black holes in higher dimensions. It was characterized by the mass and some set of angular momenta or some set of spin parameters. There was the question of uniqueness or the no-hair theorem. It certainly seemed like we had a broad range of solutions. We had uniqueness in four dimensions, and so what else could we have in higher dimensions? Similarly, when we thought about stability, well, in fact, we didn't think about stability. Again, we simply said, well, these all look like beautiful solutions, just like in four dimensions. What else could it be but that these systems are all stable? One thing that we did look at is, of course, the thermodynamics. And it seems, or one can verify very easily that the usual rules about black hole thermodynamics extend very easily to higher dimensions. And so these relations are basically unchanged. Up to the assumptions that we make in four dimensions, we have that the area is always increasing, and we just have to change that formula by adding a sum over the different possibilities for the different components of the angular momentum. And so it seems like we're in pretty good shape there. Yeah?
In that product that you write down, presumably the R squared is many different R's, right?
Sorry?
In the metric, when you've got a product form like this.
Yeah, if one were to try and push this analogy, or the idea that this is telling me about gravitational collapse, then it seems like there ought to be a more complicated story. Certainly what I was saying here is that, you know, the system was compressing in some directions, expanding in others, and so how do I really describe that system? And well, that's a failure of my analogy. It turns out that this is really the formula that we're interested in.
So does the horizon become much more complicated, and that begs the question of what area we should use in these theorems?
R here again is a coordinate position, and so it defines a well, you know, there's a well-defined surface there, and so the area that I use is just the cross-sectional area, and so I'm just integrating over the angle. You're certainly right that the, you know, the details, it's not a round sphere, it's not even a simple pancake like this. It can, you know, you can think of it as a higher dimensional ellipsoid with lots of different radii, or being stretched in lots of different directions. And so the geometry is more complicated, but there's no ambiguity about how I define the horizon or its area, and that's the thing that I'm using over there.
Is there? Are all higher dimensions automatically compactified?
Well, okay, I said that in order to make a realistic theory of our world, we had to compactify the dimensions. And so I really changed the game when I went here or here, in that I'm thinking about a theory, in fact, where none of the dimensions are compactified, where I'm allowing the space to be arbitrarily large in any direction. And so that seemed like, well, I'll comment more on that, but in part, if you like, that's why these results didn't gain that much notoriety at the time, because really the interest then was on how do I describe the real world. I mean, in 1985, we were on the verge of solving everything and producing a consistent theory of nature. And so the real focus of everybody's attention was, you know, compactifying down to four dimensions, and these were curious results. But they didn't receive a lot of attention. As I said, we didn't even study these questions here. But in fact, you know, the intuition that we had in four dimensions proved wrong. The first thing to go was, in fact, stability. And there I would... there was some work about 10 years later in 94. I'm running out of space, but that's the same year that we found black holes in the real world. There's some work by Gregory and Laflamme that goes by the GL, or the Gregory Laflamme instability now. And there, though, I'm really changing the story again slightly. I'm going back to the compactified picture. Let's just think about five dimensions on a circle. In that case, one of the things that was noted by many people was that if I had a four-dimensional metric, so let's say I had the Schwarzschild solution here, I could just, so this is a solution of R mu nu equals zero, I could just add a dz squared to the metric, and now I have a five-dimensional solution describing some kind of object that has a horizon. This object now has a symmetry, or it's translationally invariant in this extra direction, and so this turns out to be a black string, because the horizon is spherical in the three spatial dimensions here, but it's linear in the extra dimension. Of course, I could add, you know, extra coordinates here, depending on what my interest was. And so what I would have in these constructions was that my four-dimensional Schwarzschild, or my four-dimensional black hole, becomes a five-dimensional black string. If I have one Z, if I add two, I can make a black membrane. And in general, we run out of clever names after a while, and we just call these black brains. So when you hear people walking down the hall talking about black brains, this is the kind of construction that they're talking about. Now the interesting thing though, so this kind of construction was realized very early on. The interesting thing though that Gregory and Flem noted was that, well, if I have a gravitating object that extends over some long distance, in principle it could be infinite, but if we compactify, this is some, it's just a linear density of energy that's extended, and that stuff naturally wants to clump. It wants to bunch together in smaller groups, and so there's an instability in this system when we make these constructions if they're too large. And an easy way to see that is that if I take a black string like this and I've compactified my direction, there's a certain amount of energy that I've got stored in that system. I could take that same energy and I could produce a black hole with it. That black hole, now I'm assuming here, is smaller than the size of the extra dimensions, and so it's going to look very much like the black hole that Pangerlini wrote down, but it has some size governed by that formula over there. Now if I increase the mass density, you know, this black hole gets bigger here, there's more mass, so if I rearrange it and I produce a black hole, what I get is a bigger black hole. And I can continue that process. I guess I have to get rid of my string here. But the black hole, as I add more and more energy density, gets bigger and bigger. And eventually, though, it's only got a finite amount of Z to sit in, so eventually it starts running into itself. And so eventually there's no room to have a black hole inside this compact direction. And so at that point, the system doesn't have an alternative of choosing either this or this, but rather it has to choose the black string solution. And so this then characterizes, for a given energy density, a scale at which this instability will set in to the black string. So this is a fuzzy or a hand-waving kind of argument, but what Gregory and Laflamme did is they worked hard and took the solution here, or took this solution for five dimensions, say, and they looked at the perturbations of that solution. They looked for small fluctuations, and what they found was that there were instabilities, and you end up with a graph that looks something like this, where this represents the wave number. And the perturbation also grows. So this is the rate at which it grows. So the perturbation in the metric goes like this exponential. And so what this is telling me is that if I give you a certain energy density or a certain scale that sets the size of this black string, then at long wavelengths here, it's actually going to be unstable. Or there are going to be modes that will produce non-uniformity in the string. Now, that's a perturbative calculation, and so you can see the onset of the instability in that calculation. My hand-wavy discussion here suggested that what I should end up with at the end of the day is just small black holes sitting inside the fifth dimension. But one of the things that one should note is that if I really wanted to make a transition from a smooth horizon that traversed this dimension, so it would have a topology of being a sphere across the circle, if it's going to make a transition here to something that's spherical in five dimensions, that's actually going to cause, or from our knowledge of horizons and black holes over there in the early 70s, I know that there has to be some kind of singularity that appears at some point in the evolution between here and here. And so the bottom line is that we really don't know what the end state of this instability is. I think it's fair to say that the majority view is that, in fact, the story I'm telling is the correct one, that the black string makes a transition to a black hole. However, there may be some diehards like Gary here, who's smiling greatly, who hope that possibility is not, who would argue against that being the correct description of the story. It's certainly true, or it seems that at this point, with our analytic tools, that this is a story that's beyond the reach of doing a calculation with pencil or paper, or even perhaps with the help of an algebraic program on our computer. And so we really have to turn to our numerical friends and ask them what the story is, because they can, well, the hope is that using numerical techniques, we'll be able to follow this deep into the nonlinear, or the instability deep into the nonlinear regime, and we'll be able to tell, well, what the endpoint of the evolution is. And so that's one of the reasons, then, there are many problems in these higher dimensional situations where the evolution, we have a handle on what's happening perturbatively, but we really don't understand the nonlinear evolution. And so we've asked as many of our numerical friends as we can to come to the program. On the other hand, it also seems that this is a difficult problem. Some of our numerical friends, in particular Luis there, has been working on this problem, I think, for over 3 years now, on and off, to be fair. And there's some interesting results that they found, and the bottom line is, though, that we don't still know. However, they've got a good 2 months to be working on the problem, and perhaps by the end of the program we'll have the story.
Rob, are there sort of nice Penrose diagrams, or generalized Penrose diagrams that can be drawn?
There are.
And all the geodesics are sensible. And
sorry?
All the geodesics are nice.
There's if I go, for instance, well, in this case, the interesting structure the interesting part of the causal structure is that of the Schwarzschild black hole. If you go to the spinning black hole in higher dimensions, it turns out most of the story is the same. It turns out there are little things in, you know, an odd number of dimensions with so many spins where the behavior of the singularity is a little bit different. But basically, the idea or the causal structure gets preserved when you go to higher dimensions.
But it's known that there's nothing strange, such as what happens, say, in a Godel metric or something, when things are rotating.
Well, I actually went back to look at my thesis, and there are lots of interesting things there. It turns out that there, in an odd number of dimensions, sometimes the way that the solution sort of degenerates, rather than becoming a naked singularity, is that it can reveal closed time-like curves. And so it turns out that there are some interesting little curiosities like that, where you can get closed time-like curves, but they would be confined to a region near the horizon. They don't sort of pervade the entire space like in Gödel. But so there are some extra curiosities that you can find like that. I was talking, though, about the spinning black holes, and then I started talking about Gregory Laflamme saying that stability here would be lost. And so a fair question is, what does this have to do with the spinning black holes? And that was something that was actually only realized much later by Roberto Amperand and I. But if we go back to this picture here, what I said was that if I introduced a single spin, what happened was that the horizon spread out in the plane of rotation, but sort of shrank in the transverse direction. And so if I look at the metric right here near the horizon, what I see is a horizon that extends off a very large distance in two directions, i.e. in the plane of rotation, but it's curled up very tightly in the transverse dimension. And so this little piece of the geometry actually looks like a black brain or a black membrane. And so it turns out that, well, that's a situation where I might expect to see some kind of instability like this. And so we actually argued by looking at the metric in more detail that, in fact, most of these solutions with very large spin would have to be unstable. And even though in the classical solutions we saw no evidence of a Kerr bound, in fact, what you find is that dynamically gravity in higher dimensions seems to enforce a bound like that. And so it turns out then that the powers get changed. New minus two. So that, but there's some kind of bound that is dynamically enforced now by this Gregory Laflamme-like instability in the higher dimensional case. And so, well, it seems then that the dynamics of the theory is enforcing these bounds that naturally emerged in four dimensions. However, it's certainly true that the powers here are working in a way that I'm not reproducing this Regulate trajectory, and there's a story as to why I don't expect that to work, or there's a better understanding now. One question one might ask is why it took so long, and that's really, well, part of the historical perspective, that the motivation or to look at these higher dimensional solutions changed. In particular, down here at 95, the following year, there was a second superstring revolution. And one of the aftermaths of that was, well, our interest in D-brains and our ability to describe this black hole entropy over here with a microscopic or a statistical mechanical description of the states that made up the black holes. These calculations initially were done using five-dimensional black holes, and so that kind of made it all right to be thinking about black holes in higher dimensions that weren't compactified down to four dimensions. Another thing that happened later in about 98 was the idea of brain worlds. Now, brain worlds is an interesting framework, or it's a change in the paradigm that changed the way we think about the physics. Again, it was motivated by the D-brains, but the idea is that the particles we're made of, the electrons, the protons, the quarks, are confined to live in some three-dimensional, three plus one-dimensional brain that lives inside a higher-dimensional space, and that it's only gravity that sees the higher dimensions. Now, one of the consequences of that is that the energy scale associated with gravity gets lower and perhaps more accessible to gravity. But at the same time, it turns out that the size of the extra dimensions is growing for consistency to match on with the four-dimensional results. And as a result, then, in brain worlds, as a result, I end up studying scenarios where, in fact, the size that's characterizing the compactification, or the size of the extra dimensions, is bigger than the scale, the length scale that I associate with gravity in the fundamental theory, or the Planck scale. And so what that really means then is I'm in a situation where it really makes sense to study the classical Einstein equations in higher dimensions. Before, if I thought that I was compactifying, and I was compactifying the system down to about the Planck scale, then studying a black hole here would have meant that I'm studying a system where the size of the object is less than the Planck scale and where the curvatures are huge, and that's not a scenario where I really understand or expect that the classical Einstein equations are really going to govern the behavior of that object. On the other hand, if I've expanded here so that this size is now, say, of the order of a millimeter, which is huge by particle physics scales, then I can expect that this black hole that's sitting in there, even though it's very small compared to the black holes that we see in astrophysical events, that's still a black hole that's much larger than the scale where I expect to see corrections coming to Einstein's equations. And so there was a lot of activity that was motivated by trying to understand the phenomenology of these brain worlds by understanding or further studying black holes in higher dimensions. In particular, what Roberto and I had set out to do is see if we could find objects like this in the brain worlds. After all, they're very thin, and they spin in excess of the Kerr bound, and so the idea was, well, perhaps if we saw a black object like this, where the spin was much larger than the Kerr bound, that would be evidence then of this higher dimensional world. Unfortunately, along the way, what we discovered was that we shouldn't think these objects are stable, and that something like the Kerr bound kicks in when the spin gets too large. I guess it would be, close to closing, but it would be unfair to quit without pointing out one other topic of very active discussion, which addresses this question here. Apparently, our assumption about uniqueness of these solutions is also incorrect. And the way this arises, or a simple way in which you can imagine this arising, is that if I take this black string, I can imagine bending it a little bit. So it kind of looks like this, but there's a small perturbation that makes it curve around. And so you can imagine if there's a lot of room in the extra dimensions, it can curve around and make a circle. That would naturally want to collapse, but you can imagine that if I add spin to the system, that spin would be able to stabilize the forces that are causing the circle direction to collapse. And so, in fact, this uniqueness issue was resolved in a dramatic way with a counterexample, or a no, coming from Roberto Amperin and Harvey Real, who was here. And that was, 2001. And what they showed in five dimensions is they found an explicit example of a metric where I had a black string that was spinning around, and so this then was known as the black ring. And what I've got there is a horizon now. Instead of having a spherical topology in five dimensions, it has a circle or a donut shape. The topology of the horizon is S1 cross S2, or a three-dimensional sphere cross a circle. And if you study the properties of these black holes, what you find is that, well, the spinning black hole, I could draw a graph like this, where this is the area of the horizon, and I'm plotting it versus J, or the ratio of the angular momentum to mass. Turns out that these objects, there are two branches. One is a branch of fat donuts. The other is a branch of large or skinny donuts, which extends all the way off to infinity. And so here what's happening is I'm getting, well, what I described originally, a very long, skinny black string that forms a donut and is spinning around. Here, the geometry is more complicated, but basically I'm taking the donut and compressing it. And it's then, the circumference in this direction is larger than the circumference around the circle. But in particular, then, I've got a regime here we're in appropriate units. This is 1, and this is 27 over 32. But I've got a regime here where for a given ratio of spin to mass, in fact, I get 3 different choices or 3 different solutions in 5 dimensions. So there's been a lot of discussion in the past few years about these black rings, certainly here at the workshop as well. They were extended to include various charges and embedded in string theory, made supersymmetric. And however, there are some, you know, simple questions one can ask. In particular, what's the stability of an object like this? It turns out you can argue out here where it's just a long string, and so it looks very much like what I had here, that this Gregory-Laflamme instability will kick in and destabilize this. There are other arguments that say, in fact, the fat donuts are unstable. But there's this interesting regime in here where we don't really understand if there's more than one stable object, or perhaps you know, the black holes are destabilized in a certain regime there. In any event, then, that leaves us then with other questions that we're trying to, or that hopefully we might address in this program, in particular the stability of the black rings. We might ask how this uniqueness, this calculation was done only in 5 dimensions. One might ask how that extends to higher dimensions. Certainly the simple argument I gave would apply in higher dimensions. You might expect to be able to build these black rings in any number of dimensions, including 5, 6, 7 and up. On the other hand, one might be able to find more exotic objects, other kinds of topologies, by introducing these other components of the spin to stabilize various interesting geometries. So there's a great deal of exploration that is being carried out in these, well, with these very basic questions here in the program. And I think Luis succinctly summarized the situation on the weekend for me when he said, you know, for a lot of these simple questions, you guys just don't know what's going on. And so with that profound observation, I will close and thank you for your attention. Well, the solutions we know about all have singularities inside the horizon. It's certainly true over here. I said that, well, in order to get from this to this, I'm going to have to expose a singularity in the space-time. And so, well, the majority view would be then that cosmic censorship isn't going to apply in higher dimensions. There are also a lot of other exotic things, though, that I didn't talk about. There are situations where, in fact, I don't have a black hole, and, for example, what I can do is if I have my circle, it can close off or shrink to zero in the middle of the space-time somewhere. And these are known as bubble space-times. And so those are smooth space-times that are just sitting there, or they have, in some sense, a hole in the middle of them. But then again, there's the question about the future. I mean, what I described is a configuration that I can set up. One has to understand how that system evolves. And typically it really depends on the situation. Sometimes they collapse down, sometimes they expand out. But it depends on the details of what you put together.
I would like to ask a question.
Yeah.
So, when you talk about higher dimension, you're always adding spatial dimension.
Yep.
Several years ago, it's like Mars and possibly other people that I haven't heard of came here and talked about extra time dimensions. Did that stuff ever go anywhere, or what's the status?
It certainly went somewhere. It if the long-term motivation is to sort of understand the structure of string theory or understand the physics, you know, that we see at low energies here in our universe, I think the idea that there should be more than one time direction is ruled out by various people. I mean, even if the time direction, or, you know, is one of these compact directions, it turns out that leads to all sorts of interesting instabilities, which people have studied. I know Roberto's worked on that. There's sort of been complementary work in a different point of view that I know about from Ghiandavalli, and there's probably others, but I think the bottom line is that adding extra time is a bad idea, and that it leads to instabilities.
At the level of solving partial differential equations to get solutions, you could certainly do it and find solutions.
Sure, I said over here all I have to do is add something. I could put a minus sign there, and now I've got a solution as well, except I've changed the signature. So.
Any other questions? Thanks.
Okay.